planned acknowledgement, respectfully acknowledging that Contact North's work and the work of our community partners takes place on traditional Indigenous territories across the province. We are grateful to be able to work and live in these territories. We are thankful to the First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people who have cared for these territories since time immemorial and who have continued to strengthen Ontario and all communities across the province. Thank you. Okay, before we begin, just a few housekeeping items. The chat is open. Just remember to select everyone on the pull-down menu so everyone can see your comments or questions. Or sorry, comments, but if you do have questions, please enter them into the Q&A tool. You will find that tool at the bottom of your screen, and there will be some time, perhaps at the end of the session, to address those. You can upvote questions, so that's the little thumbs icon found at the bottom of each question. And if you click on that, it just means that question resonates with you, or maybe you have the same kind of question, and that will bring that question right to the top of the list. I'd also like to point out we do have closed captioning or live captioning. You can activate that through the closed caption tool at the bottom of your screen. Once the webinar is finished, I will post the link to the recording as well as the presentation slides to teachonline.ca, and I'll put that link in the chat momentarily. It will also get emailed to you in about 24 hours through our Zoom system. All right, on to the main event. I would like to introduce our speaker today, Stephen Downs, Research Associate at Contact North. Welcome, Stephen, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks. Pleasure to be here. Oh, and we've lost Sarah. So
I'm still here. I'm still here.
Okay. Okay. It's just your photo has appeared instead of you. Okay. Shall I start then, or did you have anything else you wanted to say?
That is it. The floor is yours.
Okay, thanks everybody. Welcome to this session. It's a pleasure to be here with you. I'm going to share my slides. Whoops, that's not how you do it. So that you can see my thinking in motion. And okay, and oops. Okay. Oh, my presentations always begin with a little bit of a mess. Okay, so today's topic is the future of learning technology, 10 key tools and methods. It's going to be focused mostly on technology and mostly on technology trends. I know that there's a whole bunch of other stuff to cover. I'm going to keep fairly narrowly focused. That said, the breadth of this presentation will be unfortunately staggering. So I want to remind you to keep in mind the idea here isn't for you to remember everything as I talk about it. The idea here is for you to have thoughts, whatever those thoughts are, questions, ideas, etc., and maybe jot them down or type them down as the presentation goes on. Put them in the question area. Put them in the chat area. I'm not really able to see the chat right now, but it's not for me necessarily to answer these questions. These questions are the future avenues of research and development. I want to begin by talking about briefly about the future of learning that's already here. And these are the things I won't be talking about, although pretty much everyone is talking about these days. Artificial intelligence, the tools we have for analytics, the tools we have for generating new content, deep fakes, all of that sort of thing. The tool we're using to produce the live transcription of this presentation. It's here now, and of course there's a lot going to happen, but it's not a future trend anymore. It's here now. The metaverse. Again, It's here now. It's not fully developed, and a lot of the things that I'll talk about in this presentation come from the metaverse and will apply to the metaverse. But things like virtual reality and augmented reality, these are technologies that are currently being used in a learning setting. I've done work myself developing and trying some of these VR and AR technologies, and there are widespread pilot projects and fully implemented systems today. Blockchain. Everybody's talking about blockchain again. Many of the technologies that I'm talking about today are derived from blockchain, but blockchain's something that's here now. It exists, obviously. And it's beginning to improve. We have things like non-fungible tokens or NFTs. We have things like the Ethereum merge, which converted the Ethereum blockchain to a new kind of energy efficient system of records, etc. Again, a lot of pilot projects. It isn't fully deployed, but it's not the future anymore. It's here. So these are the things that I'm not talking about. What I am talking about is where the future will go. And we can draw some lessons from the recent pandemic that we just experienced. For example, the pivot to online learning that we experienced and that we're still experiencing today with, yes, yet another Zoom presentation. It was in many ways flawed, but it was flawed in ways that helped us learn about how we really do want to do online learning in the future. As well, the pivot to remote learning exposed issues of equity and access, diversity, equity, inclusion. These things came to the fore, and we saw how existing educational systems and existing online systems are not serving all populations equally well. I live in rural Ontario, and it wasn't until the COVID pandemic that internet service providers got serious about providing broadband internet out here. So all of these issues now are in the balance as we move toward the future. We've got the existing technologies of blockchain, AI, metaverse. We've got issues of pedagogy, issues of access, and more. And then we have these future tools and methods. So what I'm going to do is talk about these future tools and methods, but these questions, these gaps still remain. And it's not for me to answer all of these questions. I have my thoughts, obviously, but the questions have to come from all of you. The answers have to come from all of you. And if there's a central message to this presentation, that might be it. So, what are these 10 things? Well, the first one is the web of data. And this is probably the most significant transformation in knowledge and learning happening right now. We are shifting from an environment where teaching and learning is conducted as a narrative, sequence of events, simple sequencing, moving from one topic to the next, a course as a series of sessions. We're moving to something different now. And what we're moving to is a course as a web of data, of interconnected data. Now, I had in my mind this lovely animation for this particular slide that I would do, where I'd have one web or graph and all of the issues, and then another one, all of the concepts, and another one, all of the models, and they all link together. But that would have taken me several weeks to make. But imagine that. And imagine a course looking like that. Imagine a course looking like this diagram that you see right in front of you. How do you teach that? We're not storytellers anymore. We're not narrators. We're now serving more in the role of explorers or guides. The web of data, some points to consider. First of all, open data. There are numerous open data initiatives just getting started. They haven't really been integrated into educational applications, but it's coming very shortly. I'm thinking of things like the Government of Canada open data initiatives, or the announcement just yesterday from Crossref that they've opened up millions of cross-referenced citations from academic publications. There's a world of open data out there, and all of that is going to become accessible and part of our courses. Another topic to consider is the idea of data literacy. I did a big project on that this past year, and you can see the link to that on the slide. Data literacy involves understanding how to look at, comprehend, manipulate, use data. And we can think of it from a variety of perspectives. We can think of it from the perspective of data management. We can think of it from the perspective of data science. We can think of it from the perspective of data literacy, information literacy, things like that. So different ways of looking at data literacy. And of course, it's going to become an increasingly important topic to consider in our educational systems of the future. Similarly, data ethics. How do we manage data? How do we collect data? How do we clean it? How do we augment it? There have been a variety of reports and inquiries on the question of data ethics. It, of course, ties directly into the question of ethics in artificial intelligence and analytics. And it also ties into ethics as related to instructional design and online learning. Finally, designing for data. And this is what's going to impact what we are doing as educational technologists most directly. How do we organize our learning materials to take into account, present, and allow people to work with all of this data that is now suddenly available to them? It's different from instructional design, because the data is live, it's dynamic, it comes from a variety of sources, and it doesn't come with instruction built in. So the way we present it and the way we organize it needs to take into account the nature of the data as well as the purpose that we have in presenting the data. Number two, told you, we're just zipping right through these. Virtualization. Now, in many respects, virtualization is already here. And some of the systems that I talk about, like VMware or Docker, have been around for a very long time. Long time in internet years, which is still shorter than the lifespan of a dog. But we haven't actually seen virtualization come into our everyday experience. It's, you know, second nature for developers and web professionals to use, and there's a lot of it's happening behind the scenes. This whole webinar is almost certainly being run in a virtual environment. But we don't have these for personal use yet, and that's what's coming. What is virtualization? Well, you take a typical computer, say your computer on your desktop, or perhaps your phone, has hardware, operating systems, and applications. That's the way it's structured. And what we do is we simulate the hardware with a virtualization layer. And so what that does is it allows us to, well, for one thing, run different operating systems and different applications on the same computer. So depending with my computer, I could run a Python application and do some artificial intelligence processing, or I could run a container with Unity or the Unreal Engine and do some virtual reality development, etc. It also allows us to take these images, once I've created an image, and run it on many different hardware platforms. So I create an application fully configured with all of its data in it once, and then I can share that with 10, 100, 1,000, a million people. So this image can run not just on my computer, but on your computer, your neighbor's computer, etc. So these new kinds of resources, these new virtualizations, allow us to redefine what we mean by textbooks or learning objects. In fact, it doesn't make sense to use a textbook anymore. And just as an aside, I don't know why people still write books. I honestly don't. When they could be doing so much more. Instead of simply getting a sequence of text, a student can access a complex computing environment already pre-configured with activities, access to data, etc., built right in. So, for example, they could work with an online interactive map with real-time traffic and weather data. Oh, yeah, just like Google Maps, but as a learning resource. Or they can build their own resources. Virtualization has allowed us to develop entire development environments specifically tailored to allowing people to build an application without having to install all of the material that they need, including text-based code, etc., on their computer. Here we have what we call a no-code application development studio. And we can see what's happening here. They're just dragging and dropping elements of their interface, or you know, they can also drag and drop data sources or resources, animations, whatever. And they're building their app and they're seeing their app appear in a virtual environment on the right-hand side of our screen here. Number three, graph. Again, it's an old concept. It's a very old concept. It's already here, but it hasn't really hit us yet. And let me draw out the distinction for you. If you're still using things like MS Word documents or PowerPoint slide presentations or even Excel, you haven't plugged into the graph yet. The graph is a network of things that are connected together. And there's a change of thinking that we need to have away from standalone documents and toward a whole set of interconnected entities. And it's a hard mindset to achieve, and you know, until it's actually working right on your desktop, it's very difficult to imagine it. But we already use the graph in many ways. For example, your social graph connects you with other people, and you already think of people and populations that way. You don't think of people, well, one person, another person, and another person. You think of groups, communities, networks, etc. You think of people as though they were a graph. A hash graph, we'll talk about that later, connects hashes. And we can think of all kinds of other graphs. I didn't create a whole bunch of slides for those. A cricket graph connects crickets, a neural graph connects neurons, etc., etc. Graphs can be of different types. For example, a graph can be directed or undirected. An undirected graph, the connection can go both ways. In a directed graph, the connection only goes one way. This is important. Time is a directed graph. It only goes one way. That becomes really important in a lot of network and data processing. I won't get into those, but trust me, it really does. Graphs can also be cyclic or acyclic. In a cyclic graph, you can create loops in the graph. But in an acyclic graph, everything eventually flows to one point. Everything flows. You never go back to where you began. So you can have a directed acyclic graph where everything flows only in one direction, and there are no cycles in that directionality. That's called a DAG, and that structure is used to underlie a lot of the technology that we already use today. Blockchain is one example of it, but if you do coding on GitHub, that's another example of it. But graphs are important not just because of the way they represent knowledge, but because of the way they allow us to access knowledge. Not simply as a collection of facts and statements, but rather as patterns that we can see. What you're looking at on the right is a graph. It's cyclic, it's undirected, but still it the properties change as the distance between the different entities in the graph changes. But we perceive movement in that graph. We see phenomena that emerge from that graph. So graphs enable the possibility of pattern recognition. And pattern recognition is an important component of knowledge and learning. As I said, graphs are everywhere in modern technology. We just don't see them yet, and we certainly don't think in them yet. And I can speak of that from personal experience, how hard it is to go from a world where I just write text in a Word document, or maybe I write computer code in a text processor, to a world like GitHub, where all of these things are connected in a graph. I've got versions, I've got, well, they don't call them masters anymore, but the main branch. We have commits, we have saves, we have blobs, tags. All of that mess that is a way of representing software. But what GitHub allows is, well, for many people to work on the same code, for the code to be maintained consistently, for us to be able to roll back to an earlier stage in the code, for us to incorporate documentation in the code. This kind of process now is also being used for web pages, Git books, and a variety of other types of content in addition to software. Blockchain is a graph. At its heart, it's a directed acyclic graph enabled by cryptography, but at its core, it's a graph. And to understand blockchain, again, chain sort of makes us think of sequences, but really we need to think of it as a graph. Neural networks, which is the core of artificial intelligence, that's a graph. Different types of neural networks, different types of machine learning algorithms are different types of graphs with different properties. Things like activation functions for each individual entity, connection weights for the connections between the entities, etc. Graphs allow us to produce the fourth item on my list, distributed resources. This is an interesting concept, it's a hard concept, but it's going to become increasingly important over time. Now, we already have, to a certain degree, distributed resources. There are things called content delivery networks out there now that many websites use. And so when you access a website like, say, the New York Times or some other prominent publisher, you're not actually retrieving a document all the way from New York. You're retrieving a copy of that content that has been cached on a nearby server. Obviously, you can see the advantage of that. The content delivery network allows us to save on a lot of internet traffic and increase access speeds. But distributed resources can be used for things like content sharing networks as well. content delivery networks are contracted by the content provider, such as, say, the New York Times. Content sharing networks, each node in the network is a standalone thing, and the content is just passed from one person to another person to another person to another person. You get the same result, many copies distributed across the network. And really the major difference between them is in the ownership and the legality. Now, the question is, how do you find a resource on a distributed network? And there's a technology called content-based addressing, or hash addressing, that's used to identify a particular piece of data. Suppose the New York Times publishes a story and puts it on their network, and then it sends out a link to that story. Well, we could look for it by location, and that's the way a lot of these systems work. There's an awful lot of overhead involved in that. Or we could look for it based on what the content actually is. And the way you do this is you take the original, what we call a pre-image, some text perhaps, or an image, or a web page, or whatever, run it through a hash function, and out the other end pops a digest, a cryptographic hash. Now, these hashes are unique for each piece of content. So the hash can be used to find the content. You simply make a request to a server on a distributed network. Do you have this hash? If they have this hash, they send you the content. And you can tell that they sent you the right content because you run the content they sent you through the same hash function to get the right result. So distributed web content protocols are in pilot phase right now. They're not widely used. They're inefficient, they're slow, they're clunky, there's a lot of overhead, a lot of the tech doesn't work, but they're becoming more and more important. So you have protocols like DAT, or the Interplanetary File System, and others that use content addressing. So what happens is, you make your request, you request it from the nearest node in the network. If the node has it, it sends it to you. If it doesn't have it, it passes the request along to other nodes. Eventually, it reaches the node that has it. The node that has it sends it to the other node and sends it to you. And that way, you're getting the content from the nearest node in the network that has it, and the content itself spreads through the network. And the more popular it is, the more it will be spread through the network.